When the Englert Theater in Iowa City was built in 1912, it cost $60,000. The complete restoration of the theater, completed in 2004, cost $5 million. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This year, the Englert Theater is turning 100. We'll talk about the history of the theater and the role it plays in Iowa City today. I'll talk with Andre Perry, executive director of the theater, and Bob Hibbs, an Iowa City historian. Later in the hour, we'll explore the intersection where art and life collide with University of Iowa theater professor Eric Forsythe. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This year, the Englert Theater in Iowa City is turning 100. So many communities in Iowa have been restoring their opera houses and theaters in the last decade, and Iowa City is no different. The Englert very nearly became a nightclub, but a committed group of citizens rescued it, raised money, and worked hard to restore it. Today, it is once again a beautiful and vibrant part of the community. This hour, we'll talk about the history of the theater and the role it plays in Iowa City today. We also want to hear your Englert memories. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Andre Perry is here with me. He is executive director of the theater. Good morning, Andre.
Morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And Bob Hibbs is here. He's an Iowa City historian. Hello, Bob.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming. And let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go back to 1912 when the Englert Theater was built. I mentioned it in the beginning of the show today. It cost $60,000 when it was built. And I'm guessing that was quite a chunk of change.
Oh, yeah. In today's dollars, that would be about $1.5 million. So it's... And then, of course, in the broad brushstrokes, it opened in 12. It was burned out by fire in 1926. And then the widow, the owner that had built it, Will and Etta Englert, he died in 1920. So she envisioned a far more grandiose theater than was originally built in 12. And it was constructed in 26. The Englert survived the, or not survived, it flourished as a film venue in the 20s and 30s, considered the golden age of film, sound film. And but it was constructed as both a playhouse for legitimate stage and a movie house, the first such venue in Iowa City.
Well, and let's go back again to that very beginning. When the theater was built, what was the vision of the Englerts? What did they want this theater to say about Iowa City?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that directly because it was a business venture for them, and they were both prominent local business people. She ran the Bon Ton Cafe, which was a trendy, highly popular cafe that had two storefronts together that are in the back part of the U.S. Bank building today there on Dubuque Street, across and down the block from Prairie Lights. But it's bank now. And he ran the Englert Ice Company, wood and ice. And so in 1911 and 12, They were living above the Bon Ton Cafe, which is just around the corner from the Englert toward the north. And when they built the Englert, they built their apartment in the front part of the Englert building and then proceeded to watch their construction of the Garden Theater across the street, which became later on the modern era, we'd know it as the Astro Theater, which is now part of the bank building as well. But They wanted a modern venue of that era, 1912, that could show a film in addition to the earlier, more vaudeville, stage-oriented stuff. But they wanted to do both. And so
even then they had a vision for making it a movie theater, even in 1912?
Mm-hmm. They had a screen, and that was all that made it a movie theater was the screen, because it wasn't a sound era yet. The sound era was still a decade away, and they were the first. They provided the first sound film in Iowa City as well. But it was opened in a grand gala operation that featured an 8-piece orchestra, the Punch Dunkel Orchestra. And interesting, on a sidelight, Punch owned the Pastime Theater, which didn't have a legitimate stage. It was just a screen operation, which was a block south where the restaurant is now in the Sheraton Hotel. That's where the Pastime was.
Well, and for people who aren't familiar with Iowa City, the Englert Theater is really in the heart of downtown Iowa City. At that time, I mean, that obviously was still the heart of downtown Iowa City, but it was a much smaller town. It sounds like there was a lot of construction, a lot of growth around that area then.
That's right. That's right. That's the first real 20th century growth spurt occurred right around this. The Paul Helen Building next door to the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City was built in the same era, the Jefferson Hotel building, which the university now uses as office building. It was built in this era. The Iowa State Bank building, which is on the corner of Pentecost, you know, right at Old Cap, it was built in this era. And lots of other prominent growth spurt stuff was built in this era. But the Englert was the showpiece of that construction process.
Tell me about the fire that almost destroyed the theater.
Well, it really just took the interior clear out. The telephone operator, the local phone company at that time, was in the building next door, which was a new 3-story building. And the operators, all through the fire, were functioning right through the other side of the wall, which was a brick wall, stone or masonry wall. And they reported the fire and functioned through it. It came up through the roof, and they had smoke in the telephone operator's office. So it was a really and at that time, also, the city hall was located right across the street and housed the fire department. And, in fact, an interesting sidelight here is that the Englert was built on the Foster and Grimm livery stable site, which had also been destroyed by fire in 1911. And the livery frequently rented the horses to the city when the firemen took their pumper rig, their nice, shiny, sparkly rigs out to fires in Iowa City. And it's hard to get into the 1920, you know, a century ago, 100 years ago, into that era in your head, and it's just so different than it is
right
now.
But a fire would be devastating at
absolutely,
that point in time.
Absolutely.
And so again, that was in 1926, and it really gutted the theater from front to back?
Yes, it just destroyed the interior of the theater almost totally. Of course, it was an auditorium-type theater anyway, so a major fire in the curtains and stuff like that is going to just fill everything, you know. And it went up through the roof. It wasn't very well contained and couldn't be in that era.
And Etta Englert, as you mentioned, she was a widow by this time. William Englert had died in 1920. So she made the decision on her own to rebuild?
Oh, I'm sure that she had other people involved. And the family, of course, the Englert family was very prominent in town and so forth. And I'm sure in the background there was a lot of other, but it was her drive and determination that really put the 1926 renovation in motion and in the grand style of that era. She was the driving force.
So it was meant to be a beautiful theater when it was built, but in this 1926 reconstruction, it went beyond that, right?
Oh, much, much, much. It changed an era. It's a whole change in era from 12 to 26. By 26, we were into the golden age of the movie theaters, you know, that were building grand bulb-burning marquees out front and all of this kind of stuff. Just garish, you know, Las Vegas.
And the Englert has a bit of a garish front to it with a lot of lights, a lot of bulbs. Is that when this came about, when the marquee came about?
Yeah. Oh, the original sign was just a flat-faced sign on the second level up there that just had just Englert Theater name up there, and no lighting, I don't think, at all. I could be wrong about that, but the sign was very plain Jane, very one-dimensional, you know, just a flat board. And Etta saw the current marquee that's there. Now, it's been redesigned and rebuilt several times since. But she is the vision. She had the vision that brought that to fact.
To put people's names up in lights.
Yep.
Right. So the theater, when it was renovated, obviously this was a wonderful time for movies, a wonderful time for theaters. But over time, just as pretty much every theater in the state of Iowa went through this transformation, as time went on, people didn't go to the movie palaces as much and they got changed. What happened to the Engler?
Well, the TV era changed the movie business, obviously. And the Engler suffered through this period and suffered through the outlying shopping center, the new theaters, and even the Englert itself, the owners divided it down the middle to make two auditoriums in the 80s. And that just destroyed the original grandeur, the grand feeling of looking up and here's the balcony and, you know, the high ceiling and all of that on a width that made the dimensions work. When you cut that thing right down the middle in half, it just... Ooh.
Yeah, but you could show twice as many movies.
Right, exactly. And that was the economics that was driving that process.
Right, and most of us remember the movie theaters of the 1980s, which were pretty functional. You went and you got your popcorn and you saw your movie, and you weren't going to be dazzled by the architecture, by the beauty of where you were watching the movie. And then as time went on, it went in 1999, the Englert almost became a nightclub?
That's right. It was offered for sale by the theater owners, and it was purchased, actually, by a local entrepreneur who was already in the bar business. And people got visions of a nightclub operation there, and it was the impetus that led to formation of the public effort that led to the modern Englert. The grand reconstruction, you got to get inside of it to appreciate what the heck the place is. I'm talking, now it also functions as a, in addition to a performance center, it also functions as an art center. So it has multiple functions now beyond just this legitimate stage, which is loaded most of the time with wonderful stuff.
Well, we will talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking with Bob Hibbs, who's an Iowa City historian. We'll bring Andre Perry into the conversation in just a moment. He is executive director of the Englert Theater, turning 100 years old this year. We'll talk about how the Englert is celebrating its centennial in a couple of minutes. We also want to hear from you. Share your Englert memories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Then coming up later this hour, I'll talk with University of Iowa Theater Professor Eric Forsyth about that intersection where art and real life collide. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the centennial of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. This theater was built in 1912, almost burned down in 1926, was rebuilt beautifully then, and then nearly became a nightclub in 1999 when a group of citizens in Iowa City revolted against that kind of progress, I guess, and raised money and worked extremely hard to renovate and save the theater. With me today is Bob Hibbs. He's an Iowa City historian, and Andre Perry, executive director of the theater. And the theater reopened in 2004 after all of this incredible renovation work. And Andre, for people who haven't been to the Englert Theater, can you describe what it looks like today?
Yeah, it is a smaller theater than it once was as far as the capacity. It's about a 730-seat space. And we've got about a 20 by 20 stage, and there's an orchestra pit as well as a balcony level. And we also have a second floor gallery where we, you know, feature regional and local art. So it's kind of a multi-purpose space, like Bob was saying in the earlier segment. We have everything from music there to stage plays to musicals to screenings of films to lectures from the University of Iowa to a lot of literary events that come through, whether they're readers who are, you know, famous nationally and internationally, as well as folks who, you know, part of the local literary scene, you know, folks who get in there and read. And then other stuff that's, you know, indescribable or unclassifiable. You know, someone comes up with an idea and they come and talk to us and we say, all right, let's find a way to make that happen.
And Bob, when people were working on this renovation, were there any big surprises that were discovered about this theater space?
I don't recall that there were any major finds of this sort of thing. Of course, when they were taking it apart, they found old wallpaper and found, you know, various aspects of the earlier incarnation of the theater. So including going way back, I think, in one section up near the front of the building that hadn't been as extensively damaged as the main auditorium was. But in that renovation also, they took box seats, which had hung on the wall and were horrible fire traps. I mean, they just didn't belong at all. And that was in the original theater, and it was taken down in the 26 fire reconstruction after that fire.
Okay. And of course, as you mentioned, it had been divided up, so they really had to gut the whole thing to rebuild
right? They sure did. They had to go basically back to bare walls and start in again. Some of it was preserved. And they would take things out and then bring them back later, you know. And I didn't follow the interior work as it was done. I was aware of what the public was getting from the media, but I didn't. It's interesting. I went to the opening, and I under the seat where we were sitting down toward the stage, and I picked up or kicked a little tiny piece of carpet. It's only a few square inches, and I picked it up, and I have that in my junk collection now. I have a room of Iowa City junk, and that's in the collection from the Englert reconstruction.
Well, I'm sure there were so many people involved in this effort. Can you give me an idea of how big this citizen coalition was that put all the pieces back together?
It's really tough. Actually, I don't know the exact number, but hundreds, I think probably literally thousands of people were involved once it all got rolling. Of course, there are people who are kind of more central, who became the nonprofit that is now the Englert Civic Theater, who really spearheaded the movement. But really, citizens all from all over the county got together, whether they contributed to small events or whether they're there for, you know, several years of the reconstruction, the fundraising, and the rebuilding.
Right. Bob, did you want to add something to that?
Well, my memory is very parallel to what Andre has just said. It was a very broad-based group of people and quite varied from university to town and gown all the way around. Everybody wanted to do some part because it was just such an obvious effort. Obvious goal, I should say, of restoring the old Englert. And it wasn't cheap. I mean, it's very expensive. But when you talk about dollars, you know, the 26 renovation cost about $1.6 million back then. And they spent a lot more than that in 2003 and 4 and 5.
Right. Number that I've seen is about $5 million.
Yeah, that's
total.
Right. That's right.
So when the theater was renovated, it was not renovated and put back to work as a business as it had been before. There was a nonprofit created. Can you tell me a little bit about the model of the Englert nonprofit?
Sure, certainly. It's a nonprofit because it serves a couple of purposes. On one side, you know, we are a programming arm. Our job is to highlight, you know, national, international, regional, and local arts happening. And so we bring those to the stage. We bring those to the theater as things that we bring to the community of Iowa City. But on the other hand, we are a community space. And so we're there to support other community groups in Iowa City. That can be on an arts level, whether it's something like the Iowa City Community Theater, you know, getting them into the space and making it more affordable so they can do productions, or whether it's something that's just, you know, a social group. Like we just had the Shelter House, which is a major, you know, homeless organization in Iowa City. They just did a major event at the Englert last week. And it's important for us to be there to have that central space downtown where they might have a small office somewhere else in, you know, in the county, but they can come down and have 500 people and, you know, bring them into the theater and they can enjoy an event and learn more about those organizations. So it's important that we're a nonprofit. We can raise money that allows us to do those sorts of things. So, you know, we program, but we're also a community asset.
Well, and I've seen theaters renovated in other communities, maybe taken over by the local theater group, you know, operating as a nonprofit. But it seems to me that operating as a nonprofit that's not necessarily affiliated with any kind of performance group gives you more freedom.
Yeah, and specific to our programming vision, when we sit down, we think about what we want to do the following year. Our goal is always that we want to try to find a reason that of all the demographics that make up our area, that someone from each of those groups would have at least one reason to come into the theater once a year. You know, obviously some people are going to come in a lot of times and some people are only going to make it once. And I'm sure there's some people who don't make it at all. And so we just have to make sure that there's a reason that we can get everyone in there, wherever they're coming from, whatever their backgrounds are, whatever their age groups are, that they can get into the theater and have a meaningful experience.
How many events do you have in a year?
That's a dangerous question. We're probably pushing around 220, 250 events a
wow.
year. And that's a mix of us programming our own events, other community organizations coming in and using the space, and then other rentals happening. The University of Iowa has been a great partner with us, bringing amazing lectures to the space. And then while some spaces were lost in the 2008 flood, we've been there as a performing arts alternative for organizations like Hancher Auditorium and for the Division of Performing Arts, which does operas and jazz performances in our space.
Is the nonprofit healthy? Is the Englert making it?
Yeah. When I came on in 2010, you know, as we were putting together, you know, kind of the team that we have in place right now, that was really the goal, was to get this thing operating in a way that it could exist not only for the 100 years it's been here, but for, you know, the next 100 or however far down the road it wants to go. So, yeah, we've been figuring it out, and it's been a really difficult job. But we're operating at capacity now, and that's where we want to be. And we want to grow and go further so that we can do more amazing things in the community and also help out other people as much as we can.
When you look around the world, were there theaters or other similar organizations that you could use as a model? Because this is fairly unusual.
There certainly are. The notion of restored theaters, just even within the state of Iowa, you're starting to see them pop up around our state, which is fantastic. And communities are just getting together and understanding that it's great to have a community space. It's great to have a performing arts space where amazing events can happen. And so, yeah, there are other examples. And I've got colleagues, you know, around the country who I talk to and ask questions, and they ask me questions. And it's just an ongoing conversation for all of us out there who are working with spaces like these. And, you know, everyone's got its specific, you know, issues or, you know, its specific challenges. But there are other people doing this sort of thing, so it is helpful.
Well, when the renovation effort was taking place, 1999 through 2004, really, and so many people were involved in the Englert, after the nonprofit was created and you started trying to operate and get your day-to-day business done, did you find that citizens wanted to stay involved? Do you have a lot of volunteers?
We still have a lot of volunteers, and there's a core group of people who put in a lot of hours. And on our board, we have a, you know, kind of a core group within our board that puts in a lot of work of assisting us. We have a really small staff. There are about, I guess, 4 full-time employees, and then below that, there are, you know, probably about 4 people who work 3/4 time. And so those are the core people, but there are always people helping out. And I think people are still learning about us. In its current iteration, the Englert is still like a very young organization. I moved to town just right after, you know, it had reopened. And, you know, in that time, it's been rebuilding its reputation, rebuilding the way in which it does things, rebuilding its programming vision. And so, you know, we're still getting out there, and people do come and help us. We can't thank them enough, all the people who support the theater.
There's one volunteer in particular that I know has been incredibly dedicated, Kent Smith. Can you tell me about Kent?
Yeah, Kent Smith is the superhero of the Englert. He's our head usher, and even though that's his title, it goes way beyond that. He's just been a core supporter of the theater, helping out in all sorts of ways of, you know, managing other volunteers, helping introduce new staff to the history of the theater, assisting the front of house staff. He's welcomed, I think we put the number together, as 270,000 patrons into the theater. It's an insane number, you know. We just had a coat, a vintage coat that the old ushers back in the 20s had at the theater. We had it reconstructed for him this year. So now if you come by the theater on an event night and you see him with this beautiful purple coat, it's a recreation of something from the 20s. So.
Oh, very cool. We're talking about the centennial of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. My guests are Andre Perry, executive director of the theater, and Bob Hibbs, who's an Iowa City historian. And what are you doing to celebrate the centennial? I know you have a lot of special events.
Yes, we're doing quite a bit of programming for the centennial. Obviously, we just have our regular schedule, which goes on, but we wanted to highlight this event or this year with some really special stuff. And what we did a balance of bringing in national acts to just celebrate the theater, and then we also wanted to focus on some more community based projects. On the national side, we have folks like the Kronos Quartet who are coming in on Thursday, October 19th October 18th to the theater. And they're coming all the way from San Francisco, and it's an international ensemble, and it's their 40th anniversary. They used to do commissions with Hancher about 12 years ago. It's their last commission, and so Iowa City actually means something to them. And so we thought it'd be great to celebrate together. They knew it was our centennial that they would come in and do a special program for us, and so that was on the national side. And then on the more local side, there's this project that we've been working on for a year called the Iowa City Song Project, where we commissioned 31 artist musicians in the area to write and record a song inspired by Iowa City, either loosely or closely. And we worked with a local engineer, Luke Tweedy, at Flat Black Studios. And he was kind of the co-producer on this project. We also worked with a couple of other engineers, John Zweck, who's been a longtime member of the community, and Colin Ritchie. And we basically corralled these musicians to write these songs, come in over the summer and record them. And we really wanted to represent the kind of span of amazing music that happens in this town and in this area. Going from roots rock legends, like Bo Ramsey and Greg Brown, who contributed to the project, some of the younger roots people like Pieta Brown and William Elliott Whitmore, and then also focusing on more of this beautiful experimental avant-garde scene that happens in Iowa City with bands like Wet Hair, who also run a record label called Night People Records. And so all together, we got 31 musicians together. They recorded these songs. And, sometimes with compilations, musicians will throw you B-sides or kind of like, throwaway tracks. But everyone brought their A-game. It's absolutely amazing the amount of music that is of amazing quality on this compilation that we're putting out on vinyl and CD and digital. So.
And that's all going to debut in early November, right?
Right. We're doing a release, a kind of series of release shows for that over the first weekend in November, with one show at the Englert with Pieta Brown and Brooke Strauss and Caroline Smith, and then a show at the Mill that's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year with some of the other bands. That's going to be a really fun time.
With other theaters around the state getting renovated, and we've talked about the Opera House project throughout the state of Iowa on this show before, and musicians are traveling around and trying to perform in all of these old venues, some of them renovated, some of them are not renovated, and the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids has been renovated. There's a new performance space in Coralville. I mean, there seems to be this movement right now to create these wonderful spaces or renovate old spaces. Does that create competition for the Englert, or is this a time that's really exciting to be in this business?
I see it both ways, which is, of course, it creates competition, and I also think that's really good for the area. Folks talk about how they want to see Iowa City, Johnson County, just the corridor grow. And in order to grow, we have to challenge ourselves, to be more active. If there's a new center in Coralville, we need to go see the performances that are happening there and see the performances at the Englert and see the things that are happening, with Hancher and these other organizations that exist in our area. It's all part of us becoming more of a cultural powerhouse than we are. And I think we're up to the task. I think we can do it. It's exciting for me. This is the area I work in. So anytime a new place comes up, my best time is trying to find, when I actually have a free day, which is rare, and deciding when I can go out and see something in another place. It's inspiring.
Bob, you want to add something?
Well, the university, as most of Iowa knows, had a major damage from floods in 2008, and it removed a lot of the venues for performing arts of all sorts. There are always upsides to things, and one of the upsides of that horrible flood is the fact that it has helped strengthen the Englert. And I applaud that, but I'm looking forward to a new Hancher coming along in the future, too, which is still a couple of years, several years away. But the Englert is a not a bridge. The Englert is a substitute for some venue lost at the university, and the university uses the Englert obviously regularly, and that has strengthened the overall operation of the Englert, I think.
We have just a minute left, Bob. And as a historian, when you go to see something at the Englert, of course, you're looking for a wonderful performance experience. But when you're in a theater like this, what should you look for? What are you hoping to experience?
You feel the ambiance. You feel the crowd. You feel the performance, whatever it is. And my favorite, because I have some hearing defects, my favorite is dance. And this only comes alive on the stage, you know. That's out of the vaudeville, old tradition of vaudeville and so forth, that still lives on the stages across Iowa. And whenever you have an opportunity to go, I can't say enough, and not just to the Englert, but to a local theater in Cedar Rapids or Des Moines or wherever, it's just the feel and the experience. You can talk about the theaters themselves, the ambiance, but you can also talk about the performance. Both sides of that equation are just fun to think about.
Bob, thank you so much. Bob Hibbs is an Iowa City historian. Andre Perry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And happy 100th.
Cheers.
Andre Perry is executive director of the Englert Theater in Iowa City, which is turning 100 this year. You can take a look at information about the history of the Englert and the present of the Englert if you go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, I will talk with University of Iowa theater professor Eric Forsyth. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. University of Iowa theater professor Eric Forsyth has been creating alternate realities for years, mostly on the stage. Today, he's here to tell us the story of a time when the alternate reality he created got uncomfortably close to the reality the rest of us experience. Eric, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Charity. Thank you.
And we're going to go back in time to the early 1980s. You were living in Philadelphia. You were working as an actor and director when you came up with an idea. Describe the idea for us.
Well, back in those days, there was the start of a new movement in theater, which was to create these murder mystery weekends. And a group of actors and I got together, and we were aware that they were generally pretty amateurish, and they were fun, but we wanted to create something unique, special, and professional. That would actually have an equity contract so that we could work in these. So our idea was, how could we connect with a public in a way that was both professional and fun and could go anywhere? So we happened on a hotel director. His name was James Batt, and he worked at Trust House 40 in this amazing chain. And he was a former actor from Britain. And he wanted to create something special for his hotel. So it was a perfect marriage. And we started at that hotel, great, wonderful place in Philadelphia. We created an event set in the 20s called the Jazz Mystery. And people would pay for a couple $400 for a weekend. We would start on Friday night. They would We had a jazz event in the ballroom. We asked people to come dressed appropriately. They would wear their 20s outfits. And we had people come from all over the country for this. One woman wore a Theda Bara costume from – how she got that, who knows. People made costumes. It was extraordinary. And we would have 100 couples, whatever, and we sent them character identities that they could play. And people really got into it, and it worked. The murder would happen on Friday night, and then the great detective, Monsieur de la Mer, would show up, and he would solve it over the course of the weekend. And then we would have a gourmet dinner on Saturday night, and on Sunday brunch, the mystery would be solved, and everybody would go home happy. It was a great, great weekend.
And no one died.
No one ever died, although we had some people arrested on the street when they went running out into the street And the Philadelphia police, who are not the gentlest souls in the world, would collar some of them. So we had some events, but no, there were no deaths. No.
Okay.
So we took the show around to other hotels within the chain, and one hotel was in Bermuda. Great. Okay, so we'll do our show in Bermuda. And we flew down, got all of our stuff ready. And I was playing as the stage manager this time so that the actors could facilitate their event.
Okay, so as stage manager, what were your responsibilities?
That means I would make sure props were set in the right place and telephone calls would come or telegrams. The band was set to play at the right time. So organizational
sorts
of things.
Right, and since this was a murder mystery that your guests were involved in solving, you had to plant clues and things like that, right?
Exactly. And on Friday night, following our pattern, we had a music event, a dance event, a jazz music playing up in the ballroom of the theater, of the hotel. And I was wandering around planting clues outside, beautiful weather, perfect evening, and I set one clue near the pool. And I looked down, and there was a pool of blood on the ground.
Real blood.
Well, that was my first impression, was that it was real blood. And I thought, no, this can't possibly be real blood at a murder mystery weekend. What this is somebody is playing a game with us and setting it up to try to make a joke of the event.
Okay, so you saw this pool of real blood and then you talked yourself out of believing that it was.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine that it actually was a pool of real blood. I mean, the coincidence was just too great. No, somebody's setting up a joke. And the thing is, it continued. There was it continued down toward the restroom by the pool, and that made me think, oh dear, someone is bleeding, and maybe I should tell somebody about this. And I thought, no, I'll investigate it first because I don't want to spoil the event that was happening upstairs, which was this international theater event. So I followed it down carefully to the restroom and sort of called out, anybody there? And got no answer. And I peeked around, and the place looked like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was dripping with red paint. I don't know, blood maybe. Really scary, and I kind of freaked out a little bit, of course. And then hello, anybody? Nobody was there. So I went in, investigated a little bit more, and found in the commode there was a girdle, a woman's girdle. Now, who wears girdles anymore? I don't know. But anyway, I thought, oh, dear, this has been a murder, rape. Oh, something horrible has happened here. I thought, no, this can't possibly be an actual crime. It's just too coincidental. So I said, I will tell people about it later. But right now I've got to finish planting my clues so that the weekend can go on appropriately. Tomorrow morning people will come down and find the clues. The maintenance will clean all this up and it'll be fine.
What is fascinating to me about this point in the story is that really, because you had created this alternate reality, you were unable to engage in reality. Could not believe your eyes.
Because I didn't know what was real and what was not real myself. And I didn't want to taste the blood or something like that to see if what it was or smell it. So I just kind of ignored it and hoped it would go away for the sake of our great weekend. So I didn't tell anybody. There didn't seem to be anybody appropriate to tell. There was a big party going on, and the party was going great, and the murder happened, and everybody was freaking out about that, and they're looking for the clues upstairs. And then everybody finally goes to bed. Okay, as did I. In the morning, I sort of peeked out my window, and the whole area was cordoned off with white, with yellow police tape. And there were, you know, this was Bermuda, so there were bobbies, the police all over the place, combing the grounds, looking for real clues about whatever had happened. And I thought, oh, dear. Horrible sinking feeling. If only maybe we would have caught the criminal if I had said anything. So anyway, I had to get the mystery event going. So I got them started at breakfast.
And what did your guests think? Did they think that this was something that you had planned?
That was the thing. They didn't know. The people who had gone out, there was some buzz about it. And they were all eager to get together at the breakfast meeting to find out what were these new clues and when can we go investigate them and so forth. And because they were actual police, they weren't letting people look at the clues. And so the guests were getting a little restive about all this. So
And at this point, you know it's a real crime. You know that you or somebody
moment,
think,
I
right,
did, yeah.
Somebody, at least that's the indication. And you were probably among the first people to see this.
Well, I was the only one the night before, certainly.
So at that point, did you go to the police?
Well, they were all there. I wanted to get my event going, and then we'd sort it out later. So we had the event, and I had to establish a couple of phone calls. And then the police called me over and said, "Sir, do you know anything about this?" And I said, "Well, let me get my – I have to plant a clue here." "No, sir, you must come this way. Just let me do this." And the hotel staff supported me in this, and I got my clue done and then went to the office. I was the bad boy then. And then, "Sir, do you know anything about this? Could we look at your shoes?" And I thought, oh my, I walked on this blood last night. So I had blood on my shoes, matching the blood of, and the footprints were mine and so forth. So at this point, I was the main suspect for the
When did that dawn on you that, wait a minute, now I am the person of interest in a real life crime?
When they said, "Let us see your shoes." And I said, "Fine, can I finish my show here? I've got the morning event. I've got all the guests." I couldn't put it together in my own mind that I had to do a play at the same time that this murder investigation, and that I was at the fulcrum of it. So I answered the questions as best I could, and they, again, the hotel staff was backing me up and trying to avoid their name in the paper, you know, the reputation and so forth. And they wanted the event to go on too. I mean, this was a big event for them. So we left it as a kind of a standoff that I wouldn't go anywhere and would be available while they looked for clues. And it was an unsolved mystery by the time. There was one other point, which was scary. They said, "Sir, do you own a gun?" And, well, the mystery, the event of the night before, the guy is killed with a blank pistol. And so, indeed, we did have a gun, and it was in my room at the time, although it was a blank pistol. Evidently, it's possible to retrofit a blank pistol and make it an actual pistol and so forth. So they confiscated the pistol. We weren't supposed to have it anyway because the island of Bermuda is weapons-free. And how did you get this into the country in the first place? And this was the early 80s, so it was before the time of all the craziness.
So we have blood all over the place. We have blood on your shoes. We have a bloody girdle.
And we have a gun.
And a gun. But was there a victim? Did they have an actual crime that they were exploring at this point?
All we had was the blood. And evidently it went – they traced it further down to the ferry, which is in the middle of Bermuda. And it came to the beach, and then the trail was lost. So evidently someone had walked along the beach dripping blood. And we couldn't tell what the girdle had to do with anything. And, of course, we were the big suspects because we had a gun and I had the blood on my shoes.
And particularly you.
Exactly. So, finally, it was a standoff. They said it probably isn't you, but we don't have anybody else, so we will allow you to return to your homeland, but don't leave town. So it was this international thing that we're going to have people watching me back home. And it was only later that we discovered that someone had broken into the house next to the – one of the wealthy houses next to the hotel on the beach, had broken through a plate glass window, a petty thief, had slit his arm on the glass of the window.
Therefore bleeding profusely.
Bleeding profusely, arterial bleeding. And to staunch the blood, he found the nearest thing to hand, which it was an elderly couple, and evidently it was a girdle that was lying around in the – so he used that to staunch the blood, and he came down and then washed his hands, washed his arm, washed the wound in the restroom, which is why the blood was all over the place there, and then made it to the ferry and home. So – but it took us several days and scary moments.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you take away from this? I mean, there was certainly this point, as I pointed out earlier, where the alternate reality you had created almost caused a split for you between what was really going on and what was supposed to be the pretend world that you had created. So in thinking back on it, what do you take away from that?
Well, I have to question every time, must the play go on? I mean, really, must it? And I think it should in a way. And then, on the other hand, shouldn't the play be infused with as much reality as reality is? I think it's a two-way street. And so what I take from it is that life and the theater are two parts of the same thing. And I love to make life better with the theater. I love to change the world with what I do, and the only way I can do that is to bring as much life as I can into the theater itself.
And if you came across a puddle of blood,
what would I do today?
What would you do today?
I probably would tell some appropriate authority, but it would spoil the play. And so I don't know. I might investigate more clearly and keep my shoes out of it.
Right, right. At least wash your shoes thoroughly, thoroughly after checking it out. Well, Eric, thank you so much for sharing this story with us today. And I know you're doing a lot of wonderful things, University of Iowa Theater. Can you give us just a brief preview?
It's one of the great programs in the country. Locally, I don't know that people know it. I'm not sure that people know that our theater building is open. All of our theaters were not damaged by the flood. We've been continuously in operation, and Summer Rep continues as our professional venue. So we're producing. We do 25 plays a year plus the summer. It's an active, fresh experience. We of course think we set the standard for the state of Iowa.
Well, Eric Forsyth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eric Forsyth is a professor of theater at the University of Iowa. And you can find out more, of course, about University of Iowa Theater and many of the events coming up this year if you look online. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. If you want to know what's coming up on Talk of Iowa and River to River, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, you can follow us on our Facebook page. We just passed the 3,000 like mark yesterday, so please join us on Facebook. Help us reach for that 4,000 mark. You can also follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. You can send us email, of course, as well. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, how changing your eating and shopping habits can impact food security for others around the world. This is Talk of Iowa.